Good day, and welcome to the media briefing on gerrymandering cases at the Supreme Court conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Katie Phillips. Please go ahead.
Hi, everyone. This is Katie Phillips from Common Cause. Thank you for joining the briefing call today on the historic gerrymandering cases that are scheduled for oral arguments at the Supreme Court on March 26th. Today we're going to get an overview of Rucho v. Common Cause and Rucho v. League of Women Voters of North Carolina. Both of them challenge Republican gerrymander in North Carolina. Taken with a companion case out of Maryland, where Democrats drew a bad map, we present the best test case for the Supreme Court to end partisan gerrymandering nationwide. I'm going to take a moment to introduce three of our guests, and then we're going to turn it over to them, and we'll take questions at the end. Seth Waxman is one of our nation's top Supreme Court and appellate advocates. Seth served as Solicitor General of the U.S. of the United States from 1997 to 2001, and many of us around here thought the fight to end gerrymandering was dead, really, until he revived the movement with a key victory a few years ago with the Supreme Court upholding the constitutionality of the Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission. We're also going to hear from Dan Vicuna on my team here. He's the National Redistricting Manager for Common Cause. Dan's an expert on the efforts to defeat gerrymandering nationwide, and he can touch specifically on the North Carolina and Maryland cases, as well as the one that bears the Common Cause name. And we're going to hear from Selena Stewart. She's the Director of Advocacy and Litigation at the League of Women Voters. Selena was redistricting counsel in Georgia for the 2011 redistricting cycle, and is an expert on the Rucho v. League of Women Voters of North Carolina case, which was consolidated with the Common Cause case. So, Seth, we'll start with you. You want to take it over?
Sure. Well, hi, everybody. So I am not counsel for either of the parties in this case, but I've committed a good portion of my professional efforts over the past almost 20 years to doing what I can to ensure that the judicial system acts to preserve the integrity of the, you know, a major predicate of the Constitution, which is that voters choose their representatives and not vice versa, and that the representatives that are chosen are beholden to the interests of their constituents and not to others. And so in this case, as in the gerrymandering case that the court considered two terms ago, Gill versus Whitford in Wisconsin, I will be filing an amicus brief on behalf of a very broad political and ideological spectrum of members of the House of Representatives. The group is still in formation, but I expect that we'll have a significant showing both by Republican, sitting Republican members and Democratic members, and even within the parties across a fairly wide ideological spectrum. So I thought I would just offer some contextual comments about the two cases that are going to be argued on the 26th. I think that these cases present the best opportunity ever for the Supreme Court to grapple with the difficult issue of whether the Constitution places judicially manageable limits on, you know, utterly raw political, partisan political gerrymandering. I think one of the most important things that the Supreme Court did in the course of the 20th century was to recognize that the Constitution does place some basic constraints on the political process, including the districting process. And gerrymandering, which is, as everyone here knows, is the practice of drawing legislative district lines to achieve the line drawer's intended result, is literally as old as our country. And it has been decried as fundamentally anti-democratic for just as long. The term gerrymander was always intended to be and is a pejorative term. The Supreme Court's initial one-person, one-vote cases like Baker versus Carr were an incredibly important first step in modernizing our democracy and conforming the rules of our politics to constitutional principles. just has been decisions applying the Voting Rights Act to strike down districting schemes that make improper use of race. But since those first cases, the court has been struggling with the question of how to articulate a workable rule that says that legislative districts can't be drawn to pick political winners and losers. And the problem of partisan political gerrymandering has grown much more urgent in recent years because the types of mapping technology and software that map drawers now have are incredibly precise, and they can be used to wring every last bit of partisan advantage out of the map for whichever party controls the state legislature at the time. And the situation we face now is that a dominant party can leverage a slight advantage in statewide popular support into a massive advantage in representation. That's just flat out an intentional distortion of the popular will, and it's a fundamental challenge to democratic principles and to the American form of government in which, as I said earlier, all political power flows from the people to their representatives. And this system of extreme partisan gerrymandering justifiably makes citizens feel like the situation is rigged. There has been a concerted effort in the courts to get the Supreme Court to actually do something about this. 15 years ago in the Veith case, members of the Supreme Court and Justice Anthony Kennedy in particular called for new ideas about how to articulate a workable standard for evaluating when a partisan gerrymander violates the Constitution. And that's what the parties in these cases and others have been doing at the trial level for the 15 intervening years. You know, as I said, the court took up one of these cases arising out of Wisconsin two terms ago in Gill versus Whitford. But in the end, the court resolved the issue on procedural grounds and left open the basic question on which it granted review and which still remains, which is, does the Constitution impose justiciable limits on partisan gerrymanders? The cases that the court is going to hear in at the end of this month are really the best generation, the best opportunity in a generation or more for the court to resolve that question. These are final decisions by trial courts finding that two states, North Carolina and Maryland, engaged in partisan gerrymandering, and they present the question squarely and rawly. In North Carolina, for example, the state officials put together about as raw a political gerrymander as you can imagine. It leveraged just over 50% popular support for the Republican Party into a carefully engineered 10-3 advantage in the state's congressional delegation. And there's no ambiguity about motive here. It was all out in the open. The state leaders said on the record and confirmed in the three-judge court proceeding that this, quote, would be a political gerrymander, and they even said that they would have made the advantage 11-2 if they could figure out, if they could have figured out how to do it. I think it's fair to say, at least my perception is, that there is a major political movement to end partisan gerrymandering in the country, and I think it crosses, it transcends party lines. You know, while the Supreme Court hasn't spoken to the issue in decades, there are good government groups, citizens groups, and leaders at the state level that have been taking action, particularly recently. Catherine mentioned the redistricting case that I argued and won in the Supreme Court a few terms ago. That was an effort led originally by states like California and Arizona that have built into their constitution the initiative process, steps that allowed the citizens to go around the state legislatures and local politicians and create an independent, nonpartisan, or bipartisan commission and allow that commission to draw fair districts. The experience, I will say, in those states shows that the road to political reform is not easy. The political parties were not supportive of the adoption of independent commissions generally, and the process in these independent redistricting states has taken many years. Now that the Supreme Court has established the constitutionality of independent redistricting commissions, notwithstanding the text of the Constitution that says that the time, place, and manner of choosing representatives to the United States Congress shall be designed by the legislatures of the several states, the court is facing the situation that we are not likely to have a state-by-state creation of an independent redistricting commissions. And these cases are therefore presenting to the court the imperative for the court to, you know, essentially enforce the fundamental principle that the Supreme Court itself has recognized, that Republican government is founded on the prospect, on the principle that voters should choose their representation. As I said earlier, the movement for reform is proceeding apace. And in 2000, in the election last fall, Colorado, Michigan, and Missouri all approved independent commissions by wide margins. Now, how they'll be implemented and what challenges will be raised is yet to be decided. But in the majority of states, political partisan gerrymandering is challengeable only in the courts, provided that the Supreme Court affirms that there are judicially manageable standards to impose. I think it's worth emphasizing, and then I'll just shut up, that there is a broad agreement among Supreme Court justices, present and past, that severe partisan gerrymandering, I'm quoting Justice Scalia in the Veith case, when he said that severe partisan gerrymanders are incompatible with democratic principles. That's an understanding that, you know, Ronald Reagan, when he was president, emphasized over and over again, calling gerrymandering a national scandal, undemocratic and un-American. And even Newt Gingrich, who was certainly a master of partisan political advantage, has since acknowledged that, you know, in the case of extreme partisan gerrymandering, each case, in his words, each party gets to rip off the public in the states where they control, but the public gets ripped off in all circumstances. The brief that we are going to be filing on behalf of the bipartisan coalition of members of the House of Representatives are not going to weigh in on the specifics of the two cases or on the particular legal tests that are being offered to the court and the court might adopt. We're really focusing on the big issue and the one that we hope the court will finally be ready to address, which is, does the Constitution set basic limits on partisan gerrymandering? And I think at that point I'll just be quiet and let those who are more involved in representing the parties in the case speak. I'm happy to take questions at the end, but.
Thanks, Seth. That was wonderful. We're going to flip it over to Dan Vecuna from Common Cause.
Hey, everybody. On March 26th, the U.S. Supreme Court is going to have really a unique opportunity to curtail partisan gerrymandering. This is a practice that erodes faith in our representative democracy and denies to voters the fundamental right to hold their elected officials accountable. This case really started in 2016 when a federal court ordered the North Carolina General Assembly to redraw the state's congressional map after ruling that two districts were an illegal racial gerrymander. As Seth sort of detailed, the North Carolina legislature engaged in a fairly unprecedented level of shamelessness in the modern history of redistricting by stating publicly and placing in written criteria that their goal, the goal of the new map would be for partisan advantage and to attempt to guarantee the election of 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats. The same General Assembly leadership and the same consultant who drew the illegal racial gerrymander then drew a map that performed exactly as they intended, with the election in 2016 of 10 Democrats and 3 Republicans, despite a relatively even popular vote split between the party's congressional candidates. Because this was such an egregious offense to fundamental constitutional values, two separate groups of plaintiffs rushed to the court to challenge the districts as an illegal partisan gerrymander. The cases, one including Common Cause, individual voters in the North Carolina Democratic Party, and another including the League of Women Voters of North Carolina and individual voters, were consolidated at the trial court level. Plaintiffs won on all of our claims at the trial court, and the Supreme Court will hear the defendant's appeal of this case in Rusho v. Common Cause. I'd like to briefly describe our legal theory of the case, discuss the Maryland case the court will hear on the same day, and then pass to Selena Stewart to describe the league's approach in Rusho. Common Cause argues that partisan gerrymandering violates the First Amendment, 14th Amendment, and Article 1, Sections 2 and 4 of the Constitution. We make the case that this plan violates 4 different strands of First Amendment jurisprudence by burdening the protected political activity of Democratic voters and the Democratic Party in North Carolina. The district court found, in particular, that associational harms targeted the North Carolina Democratic Party, including decreased ability to mobilize their base, persuade independent voters to participate, attract volunteers, raise money, and recruit candidates. Our view is that such burdening triggers strict scrutiny requiring North Carolina to demonstrate that its action was narrowly tailored to further a compelling government interest. In this case, and really in any case, no court has ruled that gerrymandering furthers any government interest, let alone a compelling one. The Common Cause plaintiffs also argue that North Carolina violated 14th Amendment equal protection. The district court established a rule requiring a showing of discriminatory intent. We demonstrated this with legislators' own words and thousands of simulated maps showing that the partisan outcome in the challenged map could not have happened without intentional efforts to discriminate. It next called for a showing of discriminatory effect. We again used computer-simulated maps to show that individual plaintiffs would have been in less packed and cracked districts in an overwhelming majority of alternative plans. Finally, the district court test called for a showing that a lack of justification there was a lack of justification in terms of a legitimate redistricting objective. It was plain to see in this case that no rational, let alone compelling, state interest was found for drawing the map as it was drawn. In a pair of claims that are unique to the Common Cause plaintiffs in the Rusho case, we successfully argued in the district court that this map also violates Article 1, Sections 2 and 4 of the Constitution. Section 2 grants to the people and not state legislatures the power to elect members of the U.S. House. Section 4 grants states a limited power to regulate the times, places, and manner of holding federal elections. The district court found that the North Carolina General Assembly violated Section 2 and far exceeded its limited authority under Section 4 when it essentially preordained the outcome of congressional elections in the state. On March 26th, the court will also hear oral arguments in Lamone v. Benesek, an appeal of a successful First Amendment challenge to Maryland's 6th Congressional District. Although former Governor Martin O'Malley and the Democratic legislature exercised the self-restraint to not shout their intentions from the rooftops like their counterparts in North Carolina, they might as well have done so. Their clear and subsequently admitted goal was to squeeze one more Democratic congressional district out of Maryland's 8-district map to increase their share from 6 to 7 of 8. They accomplished this by targeting the historically Republican 6th district for a significant makeover. The redraw changed the political complexion of the district from a strongly Republican one to a strongly Democratic one. In 2010, before the redraw, incumbent Roscoe Bartlett won by 28 percentage points, the Republican incumbent. In 2012, after the redraw, he lost by 21 points. The plaintiffs successfully argued in the trial court that Democrats' targeting of Republican voters violated the First Amendment. The district court established a test requiring a showing of intent, effect, and lack of justification. Maryland Democrats have demonstrated that they disapproved of citizen support for the Republican incumbent and succeeded in diluting Republican voters and the party's organization to prevent his reelection. Plaintiffs showed effect by demonstrating the dramatic change in the district and a successful outcome in winning a 7th Democratic seat. Finally, there was clearly no constitutionally acceptable explanation for the drastic change in the makeup of the district stretching from the far west of Maryland to the strongly Democratic suburbs of D.C. The High Court will hear Maryland's appeal to the trial court's ruling that the state violated voters' First Amendment rights. The arrival of two partisan gerrymandering cases, one in which Democrats targeted Republican voters and one in which Republicans targeted Democratic voters, is an appropriate example of what's at stake here. The fight to end gerrymandering, which Common Cause and the League of Women Voters have been at for decades in both Democratic and Republican-led states, is not one about party, it's about power. Politicians' desire to keep it and our desire to restore it to the people. So we are eagerly anticipating oral arguments and optimistic about the outcome. And with that, send it over to Selena.
Thank you. So I just want to thank everyone for joining us today. We're thrilled to have you on, and I also want to thank Katie, Seth, and Dan. Seth for laying the groundwork here, and Dan for giving such a thorough articulation of what has happened in North Carolina. So essentially, we think unconstitutional partisan gerrymandering is best understood as the packing and cracking in specific districts of voters of the disfavored party. Ultimately, this practice dilutes the strength of voters and their ability to elect candidates that they prefer. Relying on well-established legal theories of the one-person, one-vote and racial vote dilution realms, we propose, and the court easily applied, the lower court, the three-part test that Dan has already articulated, which is intent, effect, and justification. We believe the test is precise and limited, which is very important, and more importantly, is easily manageable by lower courts, just as the test under one person, one vote, and the Section 2 of VRA. We think our test is applicable most under the Equal Protection Clause of the First Amendment, as Dan has laid out, and we also, our legal theories are also based on a challenge to the First and 14th Amendment, very similar to Common Cause. I think all the litigants believe that providing evidence of discriminatory intent is the most important element or a very crucial element. In North Carolina and Maryland, we make no mistake that these are egregious examples of where government leaders did not pretend to want to create fair maps. They were very explicit in their goals. You heard Dan talk about that a little bit earlier, as well as Seth, by injecting maximum partisan bias into the enacted maps. So, clearly, all politics cannot be taken, removed from redistricting. That's unrealistic at this point, but that's the nature of our political culture at this time and has been since 1812 when good old Jerry coined the term, so to speak. But we think that the worst behavior can be reined in to restore faith in the process and to reassure voters that the electoral outcomes are not always preordained. So you're not going to walk into a booth and before you even cast a ballot, the decision is already made. So that's the premise of our legal theory. I don't want to go too much into what has already been said, and to preserve time, I will end it there.
Thank you very much, Selena. Operator, could you explain to folks how they can ask questions now?
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on the phone line will indicate when your line is open. Please state your name before posing your question. Again, press star 1 to ask a question, and we'll pause for a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal. We'll take our first question. Caller, please go ahead.
Hi, this is Susan Milligan at U.S. News and World Report. I have sort of an ancillary question here. Have you found any evidence of lower voter turnout in states where the districts are gerrymandered, that, you know, people sort of feel like there's no point in that the races are not competitive and so there's no point in turning out, which would then have this kind of, obviously, this ripple effect on other races?
You know, this is Dan DiCuni. You know, so, some of the evidence in the Maryland case suggests much lower voter turnout, for instance, amongst Republican voters in the 6th congressional district because of the fact that it's really been made out of reach to them. So I know we've definitely seen that in at least one of the cases being argued on the 26th.
Which would mean, I guess, that would put them at a disadvantage even in statewide races, right, if people aren't showing up in a particular congressional district.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely a ripple effect.
Thanks.
So we also have to consider that when, in this process, gerrymandering, the way maps are drawn, even if there is an uptick in turnout, the outcome is often still the same. And it's because of that, how Seth kind of outlined that small slice that gets a big reward. So I think it's important to capture that as well.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We'll take our next question. Caller, please go ahead.
Hi, this is Todd Ruger from CQ Roll Call. I guess this question is probably for Mr. Waxman. The Republican congressman in North Carolina filed an amicus brief in the case, and they argued it's Congress who should rein in partisan gerrymandering. They pointed to robust interest in this topic now, even though they believe that many of the bills are deeply misguided. What would your response or the response from the legislators that you're going to represent in a brief, how would you respond to that?
Well, the Constitution, you know, does permit the same constitutional provision that provides that the time, place, and manner of choosing representatives will be set by the legislatures of the several states also includes a catch-all authority for the Congress to do so. I'm not a political animal, and therefore I am uniquely unqualified to opine on the willingness and ability of this or any other Congress to do so. Congress, I believe, could constitutionally provide that for all federal House of Representatives elections, the district lines will be drawn by an independent redistricting commission. I think most people would agree that that is highly unlikely, and that other legislation reining in, addressing, and eliminating the problem of partisan gerrymandering is very unlikely. As I mentioned earlier on, reform efforts, even in the initiative states, have been hampered, not helped, by elected political representatives. And in fact, the case that the Supreme Court heard a few terms ago that I argued on behalf of the Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission was brought by the Arizona legislature. The title of the case was, you know, the Arizona legislature versus the Arizona Redistricting Commission. So I am skeptical I'm entirely confident that Congress could address this problem through its constitutional authority. I'm highly skeptical that they are likely to do so. And the question really is sort of orthogonal to the constitutional issue that is present before the justices, which is everybody recognizes that there may be all sorts of ways in theory that partisan gerrymandering could be reduced. Like everybody could just decide that since there's an agreement that partisan gerrymandering is not only undemocratic and un-American, but inconsistent with constitutional principles, that they would just stop doing it. But in the context of the world we live in which states are not, by and large, not doing it, the Supreme Court simply has to decide whether there are some general limits to strike down as unconstitutional the most extreme forms of partisan gerrymandering. I don't disagree with the principle that the federal legislative branch could take steps to solve this problem, but I'm skeptical that there's any realistic prospect that will happen, although I would applaud it. And in any event, in the absence of that, or until such time as it's done, the Supreme Court does have to decide the constitutional question that is squarely before it. And my hope is that that a majority of the justices will agree that in the case of the most extreme forms of partisan gerrymandering, courts can articulate and apply justiciable limits.
All right, thank you.
Sure.
As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. We'll take our next question.
Yeah, hi, this is Jim Morrill at the Charlotte Observer in North Carolina. The district court here has obviously ruled that the districts we have are partisan gerrymanders. What about courts elsewhere? Do you guys see any legal momentum across the country to get the outcome that you want?
Hey, this is Dan. I'll take it. As you may have seen before in 2018, the congressional method was challenged on state constitutional grounds. I think we and others are going to look to, and there's already been some research done, which state constitutions have provisions that, for fair and free elections or provisions that may be sort of even kind of clearly stronger than, what the current jurisprudence is at the federal level. We have our own lawsuit where we're challenging the state legislative map as a partisan gerrymander under the North Carolina Constitution. So I think that will be an interesting avenue to look at.
Just to piggyback on that, we saw that done in the League of Women Voters Pennsylvania case. In the Pennsylvania case, they used the state constitution to leverage a gerrymandering claim and were successful in doing that. But even more importantly, that case remained protected because it was not eligible to be appealed to any national court because it was based on their own constitution. So I think opportunities like that are going to be crucial and very, very important depending on the outcome of this court.
Thank you.
We'll take our next question. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hello.
We can
hear
you. Yep, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. My question is just sort of looking at the Supreme Court specifically, they heard the Benesec case last term and another partisan gerrymandering case last term and couldn't sort of come to an agreement on, I guess, a test for determining sort of a constitutional limit to partisan gerrymandering. Just what makes you think that they'll be able to do so this term, especially given how Justice Kennedy won't be on the court for the two cases?
I can take this. So I think that situation was a little different. So the case was punted based on standing grounds, and so the court was able to avoid would making or setting a clear standard. But I think this is different, as Seth laid out, because you have a case where the Democrats designed a gerrymandered map, and then in North Carolina we have Republicans doing it. So it's clearly a little bit different solely because we have an example where both parties have done it. So it kind of takes the political out of it a little bit because we know that gerrymandering happens by either party. Like historically, it happens by everyone, either party. But I think this case really sets the stage for a neutrally applied standard for, like Seth said, for those cases that are extreme. This would not apply to gerrymandering as a whole because gerrymandering is normal. It's a part of our process. But to pick off those extreme cases where the intent was to disenfranchise voters.
So this is Seth. I have a slightly different answer. I mean, the cases, in the last couple of terms, were cases, arising out of these very states. And what the court did the last time around was basically to say, we don't think that the plaintiffs in those cases actually have standing. That is, they do not have a particularized industry, a particularized injury sufficient to bring a lawsuit in federal court because they have to be challenging what's happening in their districts, not what's happening statewide. And so we're sending it back to the courts to see if there is some other, if there is in fact standing on a district by district claim. And by the way, we think that the same thing ought to be shown in the Maryland case that was wending its way up. And the cases went back and the lower courts have now done what the Supreme Court said had to be done. And so it wasn't as if the last time around they were saying, oh, gee, oh, dear, oh, my, we're really considering this
the substantive constitutional question, but we can't decide. What they held was that they weren't going to even confront the question that had been addressed because they found that none of the original plaintiffs in the case had demonstrated Article III standing. So they sent it back for the lower courts and the litigants to do their homework. The litigants and the lower courts have now done their homework, and it's very likely that this time the court will confront the substantive constitutional question that it found that it couldn't address last time around. Now, the question of, you know, what the outcome will be in light of recent changes in the membership of the Supreme Court is anybody's guess.
As a reminder, that is star one for questions. We'll now take our next question. Caller, please go ahead.
Hello, this is Dave Hendrickson at WRAL-TV in Raleigh, North Carolina. And the question that I have is sort of about what remedy the cases seek. If I understand correctly, if the court rules in your favor, what we are going to have is just the ability to challenge redistricting in the future based on partisan gerrymander. And in North Carolina, our districts have been tied up in lawsuits since the last census. Is there a harder remedy that will try to prevent that from happening going forward? Because I can see this challenge, you know, I can see another round of partisan gerrymandering after the coming census, followed by another 9 years of challenges and appeals.
This is Dan. I'll just take one shot at this. You know, I think if history is a guide, you know, this is a hard remedy. Well, first of all, it'd be historic in that the court is setting guidelines on partisan gerrymandering for the first time in the history of the country. But secondly, the fact that, you know, if you look at the cases requiring, you know, equal population, you know, for districts, both congressional and state legislative in different sets of cases, there was vehement opposition by legislators whose power would be threatened, but they complied. The court ruled that one person, one vote, and, you know, required an equal protection, required that districts were of equal population, and that after the census they had to be redrawn to reflect that. There was compliance. So, you know, I think in a perfect world I'd love to wave a magic wand and change districts, you know, kind of the next day. But, you know, this is the way the system works, and we'd be, you know, thrilled with that outcome.
We'll take our next question. Caller, please go ahead.
Hi, Dan. I was hoping you could answer the question you kind of raised earlier, which is, in how many states is it possible on state constitutional grounds to challenge maps as partisan gerrymandered in the event that the Supreme Court rules they're non-justiciable?
You know what? I want to say it's somewhere around a dozen, but I could do some follow up with you. I think there was some information on that in the Legal Women Voters of Pennsylvania case. The plaintiffs included the information, I think, in their brief. The Princeton redistricting Princeton gerrymandering project did a recent paper on that detailing it. So I think I can help you dig that up exactly. The numbers escaped me though exactly.
Thank you.
Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star one. It appears we have no further questions at this time. I'd like to turn the conference back to your host for any additional or closing remarks.
Great. Thanks, everyone, for joining. We'll send out a link to the audio, so you can have that soon. And if you have any follow-up questions, you can get a hold of me at kphillips@commoncause.org. My address is on the email invite that you received. So we thank you very much, and we hope to talk to you again before oral arguments on March 26th. Thanks.
That concludes today's presentation. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.